to Innovation Alberta, a program about science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm your host, Cheryl Croucher. On this evening's program, polar bears. Dr. Ian Sterling has been studying these remarkable creatures for 30 years, and his research yields clues to many things, from climate change to weight loss. The University of Alberta plays host to one of the networks of centers of excellence, this one dealing with sustainable forest management. Dr. Vic Adamovich looks upon the networks as a new way of doing science. And Mary Clark Shepherd talks about her father's work at Bitumount, which finally led to the commercialization of the Athabasca oil sands. All this coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. Earlier this year, scientists from around the world met in Edmonton to discuss their work on carbon cycles and climate change. One of the most entertaining presentations was the after-dinner talk by Dr. Ian Sterling. As a research scientist with the Canadian Wildlife Service, Ian has spent the last 30 years studying the relationship between polar bears and seals. Among the trends he's noted over the last three decades is the effects of climate warming on animals living in the South Hudson Bay region.
The principal effect that we've seen is, of course, polar bears depend on ice. And so with the warmer springs for the last almost 50 years now, there's been a very steady, statistically significant trend toward warming temperatures, particularly in April, May, and June, the spring months. And this has resulted in the ice breaking up, melting and breaking up earlier and earlier every year on average. And now it's melting about 2 to 2.5 weeks earlier than it did only 20 years ago. This means that the bears are having a shorter period of time in which they can feed on seals, and they're coming ashore in Hudson Bay because Hudson Bay gets all open water in the summertime, and every bear there has to live for 4 months just on its stored fat. It means they're coming ashore with less and less fat every year. That means their cubs aren't surviving as well. It means the females aren't producing as many cubs. It also means that if this climatic trend continues indefinitely, or it's for the next 10 or 20 or 30 years at least, we're liable to see some very different patterns in terms of the distribution of bears and the seals that they eat in Hudson Bay, and that's probably not going to be good news.
Could you elaborate on that a bit? What exactly is happening there?
Well, one of the principal predictions of the trend toward climatic warming is that we will get unseasonable and very strong weather events. And we've certainly seen that in an increase in the number of typhoons and hurricanes and so on that we've seen. We've also, in the Arctic, seen some unseasonably warm periods and rain at times of the year when normally it would be 20 or 30 below. Now, if you're an animal like a polar bear, a female polar bear that lives is in a snow den with cubs until they're big enough to be able to go out in the cold weather, or you're a seal that uses a snow berth lair dug out of a drift over a breathing hole, and you're depending on that snow to be your roof, sort of like an igloo, if you like, suddenly starts to rain a whole lot, you've lost all your protection. And what we've seen in a couple of instances where we've had what we used to call freak storms, but I have a hunch that we're liable to start seeing more of them. It means that snow is gone, that protection for those animals are gone, and you have a much higher mortality rate.
Now, just thinking about some of the things that you mentioned about bears that I didn't know about, and certainly were quite amazing, their ability to go for so many months without having to eat or defecate or urinate, how do they do that?
Well, polar bears are really quite amazing physiologically, and actually denning black bears and grizzly bears do the same thing. When bears go into what's referred to as hibernation loosely, it's not really true hibernation, but it's hibernation-like physiology in which they slow down their metabolic rate, and what that allows them to do is to metabolize their stored fat a little bit more economically. What it means is that the bears can... The bears can save energy when they need to. Now, a black bear or a grizzly bear here in Alberta, if you took food away from it in July, it would starve to death. If you took food away in the middle of October or late October, you could probably induce it to go into a den or go into a hibernation-like state physiologically a little bit earlier. But polar bears have evolved to the state that because they live in an environment where food is really quite quite variable in its time when it might be available. They can feed when it's available and then fast and go into this metabolic-like state and for periods of time at any time of the year. And that's really one of the most important adaptations that these animals have to life in the Arctic. The other really interesting thing is that when, for example, in Hudson Bay, when it's open water for 4 months, every bear has to come ashore and live on its stored fat. Adult females come ashore and they spend 8 months without feeding. They're on their own for about 4 months, and then when they're inside a frozen earth den, they give birth to their young. They're spending 8 months without feeding, and what they're able to do is take their stored fat and metabolize it. They get their water from it, their energy. They can recycle their wastes. And so for 8 months, they, in fact, do not either feed, either urinate or defecate. They just simply recycle their wastes in through metabolic pathways that are beyond my scientific training to tell you about.
Has anyone tried looking at that for, say, human space travel or just even dealing with everyday effects of diet and nutrition and losing weight?
Actually, that's a really quite a good question, and I didn't even set you up for it. But in fact, there's a fellow named Ralph Nelson at the University of Illinois who's been interested in this sort of thing for a long time, and specifically because of some of the questions that you raised: space travel, the treatment of obesity in humans, anorexia nervosa, and also kidney disease. People who have kidney failure, for example, obviously have to go on dialysis, so which is a very unpleasant process. Here these bears, for months at a time, are capable of shutting down their kidneys completely. They don't use their kidneys when they're not defecating and urinating and just recycling their energy and wastes biochemically. There's some processes there that there's a very large amount of interest in the medical community, because that there are some enormous potentials for human health and medicine.
That was Dr. Ian Sterling, a research scientist with the Canadian Wildlife Service based in Edmonton. Up next, the Sustainable Forest Management Network. You might remember a couple of weeks ago when I was speaking with wildlife biologist Dr. Daryl Hebert. He briefly mentioned his involvement with the Sustainable Forest Management Network. Daryl was the driving force behind getting this Center of Excellence established at the University of Alberta. Today, more than 100 scientists and 200 graduate and postdoctorate students from 30 universities are involved in research through the Sustainable Forest Management Network. The scientific program leader is professor and rural economist Dr. Vic Adamovich. I asked Vic for an overview of the program.
The NCE program is actually a made-in-Canada program. It's a really fascinating idea for a different way to deliver science or to address science questions. Right now, there are 18 networks of centers of excellence in Canada. This was an initiative by the federal science agencies to say, we've got to do science slightly differently for at least some of our science funding. We've got to be more interdisciplinary. We've got to have linkages between teams or groups of scientists, because Canada's a huge country. So how do we get people from the East Coast and the West Coast to share their science or to share their innovations? And how do we get them to mix with the industrial complex or the government policy complex or whatever the client groups might be or the parties of interest? And how might they actually push research in that direction? And they've really done a great job of developing these networks that try to link scientists and their own little excellent teams together. That's why it's the networks of centers of excellence. It's actually a network of individual centers of excellence, of excellent scientists working with excellent partners. So that's the first big philosophy, is sort of a pointing in one direction of a bunch of good people from across the country. The second thing is training students, development of graduate students, postdoctoral students, postdoctoral fellows. And the idea is there to train them in a different way, to train them instead of with one supervisor in one discipline, to bring them into a group of people focused on a complex problem, maybe within a couple of industrial players or maybe some government policy people at the table, so that they're analyzing an issue for their own master's degree or PhD, but in the context of the much bigger policy question or industrial question. And so it's a much richer experience for the students. And at the same time, their experience is augmented by other questions that might be raised, like the ethical implications of their research if they're doing, say, science or engineering research. Or if they're a social scientist, what are the ecological issues surrounding this? So they get a broader understanding, which is pretty rare for graduate students. Graduate students tend to be kind of narrowly slotted in away they go. And then the last bit is what's referred to as knowledge exchange, which is how do we take all this science and actually get it out there working in whatever the sector happens to be. So the NCEs have pushed really hard on making sure that the science just doesn't sit in the shelves, that it's actually developed with the endpoint in mind of being deliverable to a sector, whether it's a government or whether it's an industry or, in our case, maybe a First Nations organization.
Now, this center deals with forest issues and sustainable forest issues, and it's at the University of Alberta. How did you accomplish that?
Well, this was something that started in about 95, and it was originally funded for its first 7 years. We've just gone through a reapplication to get another 7 years of funding. So these are long-term networks, and it's really been building. There's quite a lot of momentum building. Building in the sense that new partners have come on board, new industries, new governments, new First Nations, new scientists have come on, new teams of scientists have formed. So it's a pretty exciting bunch of momentum that we've created. The focus of the network is sustainable forest management. So it's largely forestry-oriented, but it also includes forest management, but forest policy questions, First Nations community development questions, community sustainability questions in terms of northern communities, for example, economic issues. So we covered the gamut. It's not solely biological. It's not solely forestry because, of course, other sectors have an impact on the sustainability of the forest landscape. So we cover a lot of different ground. But the real focus is sustainability of the forest with all the different components, including the people.
What are some of the things that you've been looking at over the last 7 years?
Again, a variety of things. The ecological side of the network, the cornerstone, if you like, is what's called the natural disturbance hypothesis or natural disturbance management. And the notion is, what can we learn from natural processes that will help us in understanding sustainability and in understanding forest management? Can we learn some things from large-scale disturbances, fire disturbances, insect disturbances, that'll help us understand the mosaic of landscapes that are necessary for sustainability of all the variety of forest biota? How can we somehow incorporate that into management planning at a landscape level? Can we learn the same things from stand level or individual plant level, tree level, natural processes that we can manage better for both the, let's say, the economic side of the world, but also for maintaining biodiversity or maintaining some of the natural systems? That's been a fairly large part of the network, is trying to understand these natural disturbance patterns and try to pick out what we can learn and what we can apply to forest management. And it's been a real movement across the country. Almost every forestry company that we work with has in some way tried to incorporate natural disturbance or natural process principles into the way they manage the forest. At the same time, we're working with Aboriginal people in communities, building capacity, helping them develop their institutions for better meeting their needs, social needs, economic needs within communities, better understanding their values and what they'd like to see in the forest resource, as well as economic and policy questions. At times, it might not be a natural or ecological question that is a sustainability concern. It may be a certain set of policies that restrict us from achieving the kind of sustainability we'd like to see on the, even on the ecological side. So can we rethink or design new innovative policies that might actually help us achieve some sustainable management?
Now, your background and your interest is in economics. How does this fit into sustainable forestry?
In terms of the direct economics, it's obviously an issue when it comes to the size of the forest sector in Canada. This is one of our largest exporting sectors. It's very important economically for regions and in communities in northern Canada, well, all across the country in terms of manufacturing. So we have a component within the network that studies what the economic implications are of changing forest practices, how we might change economic policies to better address sustainability questions, and questions like that. My own personal area is more on what are things that are left out of the market, if you like? What are some of the values that we have that aren't captured in economic analysis or that fall between the cracks of the marketplace? Can we somehow incorporate those back into economic analysis? So whether it's recreation that's not normally priced in a market, or whether it's water quality or air quality that we don't have markets for, how do we account for those kinds of things that we do value and build them into the kind of economic analysis that we might apply to studying the best way to do forestry?
Well, you've just finished the first 7 years. What's ahead for the next seven?
I think there are two or three really interesting developments. Of course, we'll continue to work on a lot of what we were trying to set up in the first 7 years. The next 7 years, we're going to build on this natural disturbance cornerstone, if you like, to really try to turn it into management approaches and assess whether those management approaches are better in a variety of dimensions than the way that we did things in the past. We've also got a very large change of focus, if you like, to investigate what we call criterion indicators. These are ways to assess whether we are progressing towards sustainability, indicators of whether we're moving in ecological dimensions and social and economic dimensions towards what we might think of as sustainable forest management. This ties us into international sustainability policy discussions. It brings us to the forefront of an issue called certification, which is a way to link the environmental performance of the forest sector to the marketplace, where forestry companies would be certified if they manage according to sustainable principles. And then that would appear as either an access to markets where people want this kind of environmental certification, or it might appear as a kind of branding or labeling scheme to give them an advantage, if you like, within the marketplace. So an exciting link between the market and a desire for sustainability by consumers and signals back to the firms and governments as well. So we would see ourselves as being a kind of science base for those sustainability indicators and sustainability processes, saying these are the best ways to judge whether we're moving in the right direction. We have a couple of other exciting areas of research, I think, that personally would be some ones that I'm interested in. Integrated resource management, and actually trying to assess sustainability on the landscape, but with a number of different players, energy sector, tourism, forestry, agriculture, all competing for the same land base. How do we somehow think of policies to address all those different users and their wants and needs, plus the ecological concerns? Finally, one that is really interesting to me is the whole question of a fire as a disturbance agent that has a huge cost provincially to our budgets in terms of resources spent on fire suppression, in some years hundreds of millions of dollars. How do we best manage those kinds of resources? What's the best way to invest? Can we save money by thinking about landscape management to address fire suppression? What might be optimal fire suppression levels? Because we have ecological issues as well as economic and social issues when we have forest fires. So a very challenging, very complex question with potentially a very big payoff.
When you look back over the last 7 years, what's your feeling? What strikes you as being the greatest accomplishment?
We often get asked about the greatest accomplishments, and I could list off a number of papers and science issues and various things that have hit the science pages. To me, the biggest accomplishments are the people and the relationships that are developed, the networks between players that have never met together in the past, industry, university folks that now have their own little linkages, students trained in these kinds of teams that are developing the new networks. The students are really the knowledge exchange. They're the way that we're going to change forest management and land use management in the future, because they're now learning in a very different context. To me, that's the real win, is the networking between the people and the interaction and learning that's going on between these agents. And we're not in our own labs doing our own things anymore. We're moving together and trying to solve a very complex problem as groups, which to me is the way to do it. So, as I say, I could list a whole bunch of papers, but that's not as much fun as talking about the people who would have never met if it wasn't for a network approach.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That was Dr. Vic Adamovich, Professor of Rural Economy at the University of Alberta and Scientific Program Leader for the Sustainable Forest Management Network. ...1942 marked a turning point for Dr. Carl Clark. After a 10-year hiatus during the Depression, the Research Council of Alberta was revived. Once again, Clark had a lab and an assistant at his disposal, and he could continue his work on the Athabasca oil sands. He spent the next 3 years doing more refined analysis on the oil sands, and then, as his daughter Mary Clark Shepherd relates, he was ready to try his hand at another pilot plant. This eventually reunited him with his old research colleague, Sid Blair.
First of all, the Alberta government built a plant that was, it was started in 1946 and it operated in the summer of 1949. That was at Bitumen. That's about 60 miles downstream from Fort McMurray. And the reason that they chose Bitumen was that there was a very good bit of sand there that was known to work easily, and this man, Bob Fitzsimmons, who had worked it as a commercial thing and who had sold it, there was a docking facility there, and so they just used that site. So then they operated the plant in 1949, and it operated very successfully. Well, there were problems, but that was all right. So the question was, what do we do now? There was no point in just going on operating this plant at great expense. The thing to do was you had a lot of data now, and the next thing was an economic feasibility. So who should do that? Well, anyway, in the end, it was decided that Sid Blair was the person to do it. He was in Toronto. He was now an independent professional consulting engineer. He had a huge amount of experience about oil and all sorts of things. He was a very able person. And so they used University Oil Products, and the federal government mines branch were brought in, and Alberta Research Council. And Sid coordinated and wrote up the report. And that was published in December 1950. And his findings were that it was possible to mine and separate and upgrade and pipe the oil to Edmonton and to Sarnia for 40 cents less than the market price. So, as he said, it was in the realm of possibility that you could commercially develop this work. So anyway, then they said, well, now what? Well, the next step was to have a symposium. They had to get together all the information there was about this oil sands and have a big convention, symposium, they called it. And people came from all over. I've got the proceedings, so they're over there. And with the list of all the people that came, I mean, there were about 150, I think, people came from all over North America and elsewhere. And it lasted 2 or 3 days, and they had papers on all aspects of this. Mining and separation and geology and upgrading and all these things. So, and it was very prestigious. Then they took everybody up to Fort McMurray that wanted to go to Bitumen. About 100 people went up. They flew them all up. It was quite a logistical operation. So that was the symposium, and that happened in September of 51. And then it was just a matter of waiting. But then all through the 50s, the oil companies all were listening, and they were all interested. They were sending 400 pounds of oil sands to this company and 100 pounds of straight oil to this company, and all over the place they were sending oil samples. The 1956, of course, was a big year because that's when the Suez Crisis happened. And even in 52, when Mossadegh in Iran, we're still calling it Persia then, erroneously, he began flexing his muscles because there was... British had big oil concessions in Persia, dating back to the British Empire days. And he began, so that, you know, that was the first sign that things weren't going to be quite as good. So that really began to stir the oil companies. And my father used to say he was sure that they were all interested and they all knew that oil sands were going to be a big thing in the future. But they all hoped it wouldn't happen for a while. I mean, they kept saying, not yet, please, not yet, please. And eventually it became clear that yes, you know, they could look down the road and think it was time to start doing this. So, and then Great Canadian, and then there was another company called City Services, and they were the two. And but Great Canadian applied first to the Conservation Board for an application to develop, and City Service, they beat City Service out a bit to actually start commercial development. But, you know, there were big hearings, and, you know, it was a huge, and then getting the financing together, and then they had to build a pilot plant. So they both GCOS and City Service did this. GCOS got permission to build the first plant, which they opened in 1967, which was unfortunately just 9 months after my father died.
How did your father feel about seeing his work finally come to the commercialization stage?
Well, of course, I'm sure he was. I mean, he was very happy to see that it had achieved what he'd been called to do in the first place, and that was very gratifying. And of course, he did consult a lot with GCOS. They made a lot of use out of him. But as I said in All Sand Scientists, the poignant bit is that when he was in England, not long before he died, he said to me, "Oh, I just didn't like it at all. The last, I don't ever want to go up again," because seeing all the burning and slashing, that's all clearing all that overburden, was quite sad for him, because he loved the North Country. He was a great camper. He was a professional camper, as the Geological Survey people were. And the other thing that happened is that I went up to Bitumount in 1984, and what fascinated me was to see all the trees that had grown up out of this tar sand. I mean, because they'd stripped the overburden off for the Bitumount plant. They had to build a road up from the river docks up into the up above where the plant was, and they had to dig out all this tar sand for it to, they mined it, and all over the place there were trees. Now this would be, well, for this was 84, so this was 44 years after it had done. So anyway, all these trees were growing up, and so I think my father wouldn't be heartbroken anymore, but he certainly was at the time.
Thank you very much, Mary.
Well, thank you.
That was Mary Clark Shepherd, daughter of Dr. Carl Clark. Mary is working on a second book about her father's research into oil sands production. It will cover the period from 1949 to 1965. This segment of Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the Alberta Historical Resources Foundation, celebrating our rich scientific heritage. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. I welcome your comments and suggestions. Send your emails care of cheryl.croucher@ckua.org. Technical producer for Innovation Alberta is Scott Franchuk. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Good night.